Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This episode is brought to you by Carbonite. Backing up files on your PC or Mac is safe and easy with Carbonite. For a free trial plus 2 free months with purchase, go to Carbonite.com, offer code TWITPHOTO. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to TWIT Photo. This is Alex sitting in for Leo, who is on jury duty once again, and I'm here with Catherine Hall. And our guest for today, Colby Brown. Hey, Colby.
How you guys doing?
And we're going to have a great interview. I know it already, especially after last week.
I've
been looking at Colby's website and his images and what he's working on, and I'm excited. I'm excited to see this interview. But before we get to it, we're going to talk about a little tip for the day.
So we're going to launch into my tip of the day, if Tony wants to pull that up. Tony?
Maybe.
You can scroll down. Okay, so in customary, each week we're going to just look at one quick photo, and I'm going to give a tip based on this. This was taken in India, and my tip is a little bit different today. Be aware of your surroundings. And what I mean by that is, as a photographer, sometimes you get so absorbed with getting the shot and you kind of don't pay attention to what's around you. And when I was taking this photograph, I was standing in quicksand. And I started sinking, and I was like, oh, I got to get the shot. I'll get out. Da, da, da. And I didn't realize it was actually quicksand. And then 5 Indian people had to pull me out. Like, I was sinking. So, quick tip.
So the secondary tip there is just
don't stand in sand that you sink in, which is kind of a no-brainer. But anyway, point of the story is that it's not always safe to get completely absorbed. Mm-hmm. And definitely be aware of your surroundings.
And we've seen lots of photographers that have had that problem. Oh. Where you fall off a bridge.
I've almost fallen in a pool before. Yeah. When I was shooting a wedding, thank goodness I had my cards in a wedding and a waterproof pouch. But I was so wanting to get the shot, and they were in the ocean. I got slammed with a wave, and right. I was like, my whole bag got drenched. Right. And if the cards weren't in a waterproof, bad. Anyway, so that's the tip. But before I blab on about that anymore, I'm so, so, so excited and honored to have our guest here today. I was just doing, for any of you guys that know Dane Sanders, he does an awesome podcast that I was just on right before here. If you don't, check out his site, danesanders.com, and click on Conversations. But anyway, what we were talking about today was the evolution of photography with technology. And Colby Brown has been a great example of that. He's really embraced Google+, and he's used it as a platform to share with photographers, build a community, and really share all the amazing work that he's doing. So he's going to be an inspiration. I'm going to learn a lot from him, and I'm really excited to have him here. So hey, Colby, how's it going?
Doing great, Catherine. How about yourself?
Great. Awesome. So anyway, Colby, tell us about yourself. What type of photography do you do?
So I technically shoot what I consider fine art, nature, landscape photography. And I also do some humanitarian work on the side. And kind of what I mean by fine art is that I have a certain style about my work where it's very moody or atmospheric, which kind of separates it a little bit from your average photos out there. So
one thing that's great about Colby is he's similar to Jasmine. He actually didn't pick up a digital SLR until 2006. So I think his story is really inspirational for emerging photographers out there, that he's done a lot in 5 years. And one of the interesting things about him too is he wasn't formally educated. So Colby, in 2006, you pick up your first digital SLR. How did you teach yourself photography?
Well, at the time, I had saved up a little bit of my own money in order to pursue this newfound passion of mine. And what I did is I bought my first camera, digital SLR camera, which is a Canon XTI. and I ended up buying a handful of books that taught myself the kind of physics of light and exposure, whether that's, you know, ISO and shutter speed and aperture and kind of how it all correlates. And I started traveling around at the time. I was actually living in British Columbia. I'm actually a dual citizen. And I was traveling around taking a lot of really, really bad photos and learning from my mistakes. I'd go out and shoot in the morning and shoot in the evening and then come back and spend most of the bulk of the day kind of devouring my work and kind of figuring out why some stuff was good and why others was really, really bad. And it kind of really helped me to learn from, you know, that starting point to see a level of not only progression, but also to, you know, really learn where I was making mistakes and where I can improve on. And I think that's a good point for most photographers out there.
So do you feel like, I mean, you obviously use books as a resource, but do you feel like most of your learning came from just getting out there and shooting and then reviewing your work?
I think for the most part. I mean, I think that, you know, I think books are great to give you a basic understanding of exposure, because, you know, there's a lot of math involved in assuming that you're not just relying on your camera to do everything for you. When it comes to exposing correctly, which is a very loose term, but I found that hands-on experience from me making lots of mistakes and learning from them was by far the biggest help in furthering my photo skills over the years. And that happens to this day. I mean, I go on a trip. I just got back from 27 days working in Nepal and Tibet, and I'll go back through and I'll certainly have a handful of ones that I'm really happy with, and then I'll go through and teach myself from the photos that didn't turn out quite well, even though I thought they might have after looking at them at the back of the camera once I took them.
So you speak of mistakes that you made that you learned from. Can you enlighten us with some examples of those mistakes?
Sure. Well, I mean, as you're delving into, you know, photography, there's so many different facets, whether you're talking about shooting people, you're shooting landscapes, and kind of over time, I realized that I was gravitating a little bit more towards nature landscape, which is the bulk of what I do now. But even within nature landscape, you know, having a understanding of depth of field, having an understanding of shutter speed. I mean, I'd sit out on the beaches around Vancouver and watch the waves crash on the rocks, and I'd take a lot of photos, and I'd play around with my settings in order to figure out what worked and what didn't. Same thing would go, I'd sit on my porch in my backyard and watch the water droplets come down, and I'd use what macro lens I had at the time, which I believe was a 75 to 30 Canon lens, and basically just take as many photos as I could so that when I saw ones that worked out, I'd look at their settings and I'd study them pretty intently so that the next time I went out, I can improve myself. And it was a gradual progression.
Can I put you on the spot and ask you to come up with an assignment for our viewers?
An assignment?
Yeah.
Ooh, those are always fun. Sure. I mean, for me, and one of my tips that I think we might talk about here a little bit later is kind of it talks about discovery and finding inspiration and where you're at. And I think that an easy lesson to teach yourself is about depth of field. And you can walk around your neighborhood and go take pictures of kind of your neighbor's flowers and things that are kind of out in, you know, on public sidewalks and whatnot. I think a great lesson would be depth of field. So play around with your aperture and really start to learn what shallow depth of field to having things completely wide open and how it changes the overall appearance of your image and whatnot. So, get out there and try to shoot some flowers around your local area or in your own backyard. I think you might learn more than you think.
So what would you say is your average depth of field, the most common one when shooting a landscape?
Shooting landscape, typically you stay between f9 and f11. That's kind of the bread and butter. That's when you're kind of shooting at a depth of field where typically most lenses are the sharpest. And it's good for when you have images that have a subject where your background and your foreground are, it doesn't necessarily matter so much in depicting a difference, either having a shallow depth of field or having a much greater one. Most interesting photography when you're talking about landscape actually probably has a much higher f-stop number, because that allows you to have your foreground and your background more in focus together. And this image right here, actually, that you guys are showing right now is a good example of that. That was taken in the Mesquite Sand Dunes in Death Valley National Park. And, you know, if you look closely at the high-resolution file, you could see that there's details in the sand waves. And then if you get back into the mountains, it's not blurry and hazy and whatnot. If I used F11, I would not be able to capture that complete depth of field. So, you know, there's it's actually a good lesson in the sense that there are no rules in photography. So there are some guidelines that might help you, but you should certainly kind of step outside your range and play around a little bit.
What would you say are your traditional setting with your portraits? What aperture do you like to sit at?
I usually like to drop down and have a pretty wide open depth of field. And you can look at this image right here. This was taken in Haiti, where the background is really blurred, and that really allows me to focus in on a subject. For this, it was actually the eyes of this Haitian guy that was actually cleaning some of the streets after the earthquake. So I'd probably stick around anywhere from 2.8 to 4.0. And the reason that I do that is because a lot of the places that I work are actually really, there's really bad lighting. So when I work in like IDP camps in places like Haiti, or I do work with smaller organizations in Guatemala or whatnot, I'm typically in, huts or areas where there's no natural light or maybe no electricity or things like that. So you kind of have to improvise a little bit. But I think having a shallower depth of field works a little bit better.
What's your favorite lens when you're shooting portraits? Like what millimeter setting are you most commonly at?
For portraits, I love using my macro lens for portraits. So I'm a Canon guy.
Oh, really?
I have a Canon 100 millimeter 2.8 L. It's the ISO, the IS one. It's really, really sharp. And I found that when I use that either on my 5D Mark II, which is a full frame body, or my crop sensor, which is my 1D4, it's a really nice millimeter range in order to capture more close-up portrait photography. And that's kind of, if you look through my portfolio, you'll see a lot more of it, a lot more details. And by using a really, really sharp lens, even wide open, like the macro, the 100 millimeter macro, you get some really, really interesting stuff that you might not have otherwise.
Yeah. And when you're doing these shots, what are you lighting with them? Are you using natural light most of the time?
Always natural light. I always joke around because I teach a lot of workshops and I actually get this question a lot. I actually think I'm allergic to using flash. Like there's just something about it that is a little bit foreign to me. I'm sure I can maybe further my own education and get a little bit better with it. But for the most part, I try to use as much natural light as possible. That being said, I do carry around a reflector so that I can kind of bounce ambient light off in order to create a little bit more unique lighting situations for some portraits. But for the most part, it's all ambient light.
So what about you? You always seem to have a lot of your portraits have this really beautiful catch light. That's almost exaggerated. You can see with your black and white close-ups very easily. Are you doing anything unique to get that?
I'm not. I mean, I'm just.
And that's you're in all your shots. You realize that, right?
Yes, I do, and it's actually intentional. I mean, for me, eyes are really powerful to me, and I think for my portrait work, which is typically just my humanitarian photography, I think eyes tell a massive story, and I think that's a good for me. That's very intentional. So when I'm shooting like this photo of this Haitian boy just outside a camp in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, I'm exposing correctly for their skin, which allows me to also expose for their pupil, and it's a little bit dark, a little bit easier with darker complected people, but. It's certainly something I look for. And when I go in through post-processing, I mean, I'd be lying if I don't add a touch of light to the eye in order to bring it out a little bit. But for the most part, it's pretty natural. I mean, this photo personally was a little bit cropped in. But for the most part, I try to keep it as natural as possible.
I really like the... I shoot a lot in Africa. And and I've kind of taken to the same thing. And I think it's the first time I've seen someone else really doing a lot of that, where you expose that skin properly.
Yeah.
And it.
Yeah, definitely.
And I think it makes it look heavenly.
Yeah, it does.
There's this kind of it makes everything you shoot feel that way, and it's just a great. And you really get all that detail that a lot of times you lose if you try to expose the whole scene
exactly
with dark complexion. And I really like the look a lot.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you very much. The intention behind finding the details, I actually like the blown out background because it highlights your subject so much more. So, especially again with dark complected people, there is something that doesn't typically happen out there where people try to have that overall perfect perfect exposure. And for me, this is much more my style and definitely something I find.
It feels very stark, and
right.
that contrast, yeah. Having that really white background that really allows the subject to pop. You seem to have your portraits are very intimate. How are you getting this rapport with your subjects? How much time are you spending with them before you're shooting?
Well, again, with a lot of my portraits being my humanitarian work, I usually have a little bit more flexibility in engaging my subject matter. So For my work in Haiti, which is the majority of stuff that you guys are showing right now, I actually started a small organization, I guess organization is the correct term, that provides a free service to NGOs on the ground in Haiti doing great, great things. And so by connecting with these organizations, I was able to get into the back door of a lot of places that a lot of other photographers can't necessarily get to. So striking up a conversation, talking to individuals, hearing their story, and then taking their photos makes a huge difference, especially in a place like Haiti, where you have so many photojournalists kind of just always surrounding it, and taking photos and running away. I always found that having conversations and engaging with individuals makes your images 10 times more powerful and allows you to tell a story with someone's face so much easier than trying to force it just because you're on a time constraint.
And do you have the same experience that, I mean, when I'm shooting overseas, especially while I'm shooting in Africa, is that a lot of times when you're taking those photos, they are sometimes they're the only photos they have of their family and so there's a certain level of, you know, do you do anything when you're taking photos there of making sure you leave them a copy of the photo that you took?
I try to if I can. Some mm-hmm. places don't necessarily make that too feasible, right. But I always get everyone's information. So when I do work with either an organization or a specific family that's tied to an organization, I get their address, and I end up either sending prints back, usually just small prints, 4x6s or 5x7s, depending on what it is, so that these people can have some prints of their own. Because you're right, most people don't, and they actually cherish it. I mean, it's something that was always surprising when I first got into travel photography, is that, you know, people didn't have any historical evidence of themselves or what they looked like even just a few years ago, and it can be very powerful.
I mean, when you say you spend time with them, just to give me and our viewers an idea, yeah. Are you spending a day with them? Are you spending a couple hours with them? Are you spending 20 minutes with them? I'm sure it varies, but what would you say is kind of a rule of thumb with that?
It's usually probably a couple hours. I mean, I'm very selective in my photography work. So, you know, I've been shooting for, you know, 8 years, 6 years more professionally. And I think that, you know, even through that time, I only have like 14,000 images probably in my library. And it's because I'm very, very selective. So by spending more time, you know, with individuals, most likely it's probably a couple hours, it allows me to kind of engage in that aspect of my work that I think fits better, which again is understanding my subject matter. And that works for my landscape stuff too. I typically do a lot of research or will spend a lot of time in an area before I really am able to document it how I want to. And it's about understanding. It's about knowledge and research.
Well, I think too it comes from experience, where when I was initially shooting a lot of travel work, I shot so many subjects and I really needed to get that feedback, get home, see what I liked. And then as you learn your skill and your craft more and more, you become aware of what subjects are going to be successful for you. And right. So you have at that point the luxury of spending more time, because you're not shooting every single person, you know, especially Colby, when you're traveling, everything looks eccentric. I mean, everything looks right. Cool. And it's kind of like, oh, I want to get this. I want to get that. I want to get those. And then you're sort of divided. And I found at first it was healthy for me to do that, so I could get images back, get feedback. And then I started to say, after a while, you start to see what faces are interesting to you. And then you end up spending more time with those people. So you may have traveled for 2 weeks and only photographed 30 people. Mm-hmm. Or whereas before, it may have been 200 people when you were initially getting started. Right. Did you find that growth period for you as well? Or did you always kind of set on, you know, you knew who would be good or who wouldn't?
No. I definitely had a growth period. And I think that kind of goes to all facets of photography, you know, understanding not only who you like to shoot, but also developing how you shoot, I think is very key. You know, this day and age with the industry changing so much and more and more photographers entering the market, I think putting a piece of yourself into your photos is quite big and kind of helps tell a story and helps separate yourself from the fold. And so over time, I've developed not only a sense of how my images are edited, but also kind of how I shoot them and the subject matter that I like. So again, I think it's all full. I think it all kind of comes in together.
So we talk a lot about, everyone wants to know about gear and what's in your bag. And I think it's really interesting. When Colby was initially getting started, he was traveling the world with a 4 megapixel camera. And yep. Tell me about what's going on with those images with a point-and-shoot, 4 megapixel point-and-shoot camera.
For sure. So when I first started like figuring out that I had an inkling for photography was when I was traveling around the Pacific Rim, around Australia, New Zealand. At the time, I had a Kodak 6490 4.1 megapixel camera, which actually I just got rid of. Actually, just last year, I gave it to a Haitian family. It was an amazing camera at the time. I had like one of those, I think it had like 20 times zoom or something like that. This is back in 2004. And I took a lot of images during that trip. And to this day, I still hang images. I still sell images that I took with that 4.1 megapixel camera. Advances in technology has certainly helped to allow me in order to blow them up bigger than I was to before. But today, I still sell stuff from my point and shoot.
Yeah, I think that's a really important message for, you know, people out there that may not have the luxury of buying SLRs and lenses or may not want to carry them, quite frankly. Right. You know, and the point and shoot technology has obviously changed so much.
Well, nowadays, I mean, you get for $180, I mean, you can have a 12 megapixel camera. It's got
I
all
know,
this stuff on
it's
it.
Insane. And, yeah. I mean, and then your freaking iPhone. I mean, our cameras become obsolete. I mean, really. So it's just interesting how much that's shifting and changing. I think one of the things that's great about Colby is he's doing a genre of photography that's very romanticized. Travel photography. Everyone wants to be a travel photographer. And he's talked a lot about these trips. And I think often people want to know, there's kind of a disconnect of how did you become a travel photographer? How did you fund all these trips in the beginning? Can you kind of walk through your path into doing this very highly competitive field of photography?
For sure. And I'll try to shorten it for time constraints. But after I graduated from college, I was very, as you said, Catherine, I was very, I had a very romanticized idea about wanting to get into photography. And basically what I did is I was working at an 8-to-5 job and I ended up selling everything that I had. I had saved up quite a bit of money at this time as well and moved up to British Columbia. And that's where, as I mentioned, I started learning about photography. Once I got to a certain confidence level, I again decided that I really wanted to explore Southeast Asia. So I bought a one-way ticket over to Bangkok. And on the flight over to Southeast Asia, there was a woman sitting next to me that was from Jackson Hole, Wyoming. And she'd been going out to the southern parts of Thailand and the Krabi Peninsula to go climbing out in the limestone cliffs out there. She'd fallen in love with a local Thai over the years and was actually going to get married. When I met her, one of her friends was a photographer that had to back out at the last second, and I was able to convince or finagle my way into her hiring me. And my first paying photography job ever was shooting a traditional Buddhist wedding in a rural part of southern Thailand in the middle of nowhere. And it kind of spurred a lot of my career from that point. Not only did he give me the confidence in order to be a photographer and you know that this could be a reality, but also to kind of was a launch pad for everything else that I've kind of done since.
So I find that fascinating that your first paid job was a wedding. Because most
for
people
sure.
are very scared of shooting weddings. I mean, that's a lot of pressure. And then not only that, but it was in a completely different type of culture. So you're not even used to the sort of ebb and flow of the ceremony and whatnot. How did you face your fears and say, I'm going to convince this lady into hiring me?
Well, I mean, at this point, I already knew that I really wanted to travel. And like I said, I kind of had that naive, romanticized idea of combining photography with it without having any formal education, without having any business sense of it. Honestly, what I think it came down to was that I was on the plane. I was ready to go to this, you know, romanticized area of the world, Southeast Asia. And that I knew that this was an opportunity that I didn't want to let go. I didn't want to look back 10 years from this point and be like, you know what? What if I actually did ask her? What if I did, you know, put myself out in order to get this job, in order to spur other things? And I think that that in itself really helped me build my own confidence, because I think at the time I was a little bit shaky. I was still building confidence in my own work, but, you know, being paid for something, let alone someone's wedding, let alone a wedding in a country I've never been to, let alone in a Buddhist ceremony that I've never seen before, can be daunting. But in the end, like most things in my life, I think jumping in head first and just kind of seeing what happens typically seems to work out for some reason for me. So.
Yeah, I mean, so at this point you weren't able, I mean, you're just getting started. You're not making money yet as a photographer. How were you able to fund these trips when you were getting your feet wet?
This was all pretty much mostly funded in the beginning, was from the money that I saved up, as well as from picking up kind of some small photography jobs. So after this wedding that I did in southern Thailand, I traveled around Southeast Asia for another 6 or 7 months, picking up whatever jobs I could. I did a lot of travel writing, wrote for some blogs and did some stuff. And it was usually enough to be a little bit sustainable as far as helping me continue to travel. But it wasn't anything that was in the longevity could happen. So for the most part, it was just me saving up money and selling most of the material possessions that I didn't really care for anyway after college.
How long did it take you before you were really turning this into your... I mean, so that was your first... How long were you in Asia?
That was 2006, right, Colby?
That was 2006.
Yeah.
It wasn't until the next year. So I spent spending six months in Southeast Asia.
Wow.
I came back for a short break and then actually... kind of was able to follow a childhood dream to go out to Nepal and the Himalayas. I'd always, for some reason, wanted to go out there. I've been kind of big into mountain climbing since I was, or mountain exploring, I guess, since I was little. And so I went back out to Nepal, traveled around for 3 months, kind of living in the Himalayas and again, building up a portfolio, doing some stuff. Still wasn't sustainable this time, just making some extra money here or there. When I came back from that job, in my mail was a catalog for National Geographic expeditions. I flipped through it and started looking at both the trips and the instructors and kind of had an idea that, you know, maybe I could do this. Maybe by this time I'd been traveling for a long time. I'd started to develop a little bit more of an eye for my own photography work and felt that my work was quality enough. I made a couple phone calls and ended up getting in touch with the right people, sent in my resume. 2 months later, I had a phone interview or a video interview over the internet, which is my first one, which was a little bit weird. But then about a month after that, I got a phone call saying that they wanted to send me to South America. And working for National Geographic, teaching photography, it was actually teaching adventure travel photography for their expeditions. Mostly for their college students and high school students, really helped propel pretty much everything else that I've done since. And it was a good foot in the door with them. And also, you know, it's a good resume patter in order to secure future jobs. So it was that point that things really changed from a hobby that happened to make some money on the side to this is my career, this is what I want to do, and I need to take this seriously.
Yeah, I think there's two really important messages here. The first one being that, you know, you create your own opportunities, and well, actually that applies for both. You create your own opportunities. So, you know, with the travel photography thing, you set a priority, and if this is important to you, then you sacrifice. You sell all your whatever, whether it's selling your belongings like he did, whether it's, you know, when I was first getting started, I was living in New York, and I walked 45 minutes to, I worked at Getty Images, walked 45 minutes to Getty because I didn't want to pay $2 for the subway. And that seems like not a big deal, but $4 adds up in the day, you know, and each day. And it was because travel was my priority. I wanted to get out there and experience the world and explore with my camera. So I didn't go to dinners. I didn't take taxis. Right. I didn't take, you know, all these little things. And I think it comes down to choices and what your priorities are. And I think you can do whatever you want.
Right. It doesn't seem like it's one of those things that you, with photography, especially people who succeed at this tend to be, as a business, tend to be really committed. I mean, it's not something that's going to come easy.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I think it's easy to judge from the outside. And I know with our last guest, we had Jasmine on, and I've heard, you know, it's interesting. I think people get a little bit upset when other people are doing maybe something they want to do, and they assume things like, mm-hmm. oh, she's able to do this because she has a rich husband. Or, oh, his parents must have supported him. He was young, and right. he was able to jaunt off. But in actuality, if you listen to people and they talk, when you talk to these successful photographers, it's not that at all. It's just they're dedicated, they're hardworking, right. and they're
resourceful.
They're priorities. Yeah, they're resourceful. And they're not saying, I can't do something because I don't have the resources. They're saying, mm-hmm. I'm just going to make it happen.
Right.
You know? So do you have anything to say on that, Colby?
I think the only piece that I'd add in, and I agree 100% with whatever you just said, is kind of the importance of the business side of photography. So I think a lot of people are not only daunted by the challenges of understanding photography, how to take good images and whatnot, but, you know, all of the pinnacle people in our industry, all the, you know, the Scott Kelbys and those guys are amazing business people as well. So I think it takes determination, it takes persistence, it takes talent, And it needs to take a will to kind of step outside your bounds. I think for most photographers, you know, the business side of photography is something that they don't necessarily comprehend just yet, I think. And I think that's something that a lot of people could easily take local business classes or do things, because running an entrepreneurship, which is, you know, running your own photography company, is no different than, you know, running your only local store. I mean, you still have clients, you still have customers, you still have revenue streams and pieces like that. And, you know, understanding all that and how it works together, I think, is another big key in order to make it, you know, make your dream of becoming a professional photographer in the sense that you're doing it full time a reality.
So
cash flow is king.
Yeah.
Cash flow is
so king. For those out there that are just getting into photography, into traveling photography, or those who've done it forever, do you have a tip? Like, what's your number one tip for a travel photographer?
My number one tip for a travel photographer.
I like putting you on the spot. It's really fun.
I know.
If there's not sweating going on, we're not doing a good job.
I got my fan behind me, so it's keeping me cool. It's all right. I think for travel photography, it goes a little bit to what we were talking about before, which is stepping outside of your bounds of what you're comfortable with. Travel photography, typically you're shooting a lot of individuals. You're shooting cultures that are outside of your realm of experience. You know, I think that kind of trying to drop those boundaries that we put up for ourselves and really engage a culture, really engage a location, really engage an individual will allow you to not only increase your skills, but also get the type of work that you want. I think too many travel photographers that I know that are first getting into it are like, how do I approach people? How do I do all this stuff? People are people. You can still have conversations. You still get to know people before you shoot them. You know, if you're walking around a market in your own town, like in your local Safeway or something, would you want someone just randomly taking photos of you? Probably not. But if you had a conversation, you engage and you ask them, it's a little bit different story. So I definitely say a mixture of engagement and stepping outside your boundaries.
So how are you dealing with the boundary of language? You know, you're engaging with your subjects, whether speaking with them, communicating with them in some way, shape, or form, especially when you're shooting them, if you're not speaking their native language.
Definitely. Well, when it comes down to something like that, then, you know, typically I either have a translator with me. So like in Haiti, I have a fixture that kind of drives around with us and helps, you know, helps us navigate the crazy streets and talk to people. But I think that for a lot of other countries, it's, again, really easy in your initial research to understand some key phrases. And you know, the biggest phrase for most photographers when you're traveling is, hi, can I take a photo of you? Even something as simple as that breaks down a boundary that most people might have up if you can't have it. If you can't or you didn't learn the language, then you can always resort to professional charades, which is, you know, just acknowledging that they're saying, you know, saying hello, waving.
It's like a real slow
camera. Yeah, exactly. And you'd be surprised. I mean, I travel around Vietnam when I was in Southeast Asia when I first started out. For 3 months, I only knew a couple small phrases of stuff. I rented a motorcycle. I went through the Central Highlands for 2 months, where I'd go about 14 to 20 days at a time without seeing anyone else that spoke English. I was still able to get around. I was still able to find accommodation. I was still able to find food. You just start getting a little bit creative with how you engage. I mean, you know, verbal communication is only a small percentage of how we communicate as human species. So it's definitely something that people shouldn't feel daunted about.
Yeah. All right.
That's great.
Yeah.
Now, does anyone ever ask you to be paid for getting their picture taken?
Yeah. Well, depending on the location, and again, I mean, whether you're talking about Haiti or, I mean, most of the work that I do is in undeveloped countries around the world, it certainly gets brought up at time. And I think that's kind of it's a delicate double-edged sword of, you know, you want to get images, you want to get the, you know, real stuff. You don't want to take advantage of a person or a society or a situation. But at the end of the day, I try to be very careful. I try not to offer money for taking photos of people. I try not to give kids candy, things like that. If I do anything, it'll be worth a local organization on the ground that really is doing stuff. I mean, a lot of people think when they travel, it's like, oh, hey, I can give this kid a lollipop and then take a photo. They don't really think about the repercussions of the fact that the sugar in that lollipop will ultimately, you know, has a potential to destroy this kid's teeth who has no dentist system, and you know, all sorts of ramifications like that. So it's always much better to go after an organization that knows what they're doing.
Well, yeah, and going back with what you were just saying is, I think the relationship that you're building with your subjects, you're not just grabbing and shooting and walking away, you're building a rapport. And so it's kind of becomes a sharing thing. So, I mean, at least that's how it is for me too. And I find that they don't expect payment because they feel like the whole experience was reward enough, you know? Right. And, you know, I'm not, there's definitely times, there's exceptions where I've given something, or, you know, or, but I typically feel like it actually cheapens the experience.
Well, I approach it differently. I'll shoot a lot of sculptors, and sculptors are kind of in like Tanzania or Zimbabwe, and they have a lot of people go through their little area and take pictures and stuff like that. So they're kind of hardened.
Yeah.
And they're
you
need to, you'll get one of these. You're gonna pay me
before
for this.
You even pull up your camera.
You start bringing them, they just look at you like, okay. And the thing is that if I pay for it though, I treat them like a model. I mean, and what I mean by that is I'm paying them to be part of that, and I'll take. Instead of taking one photo here or there, I'll take 200 photos of them working in three videos. Okay, here's $5. I paid you, and I literally consider it like a model. Okay, now you're going to... And just keep on doing whatever you're doing, but the point is that I'm going to get my, get my money's worth. I take it from all these different angles and all this other stuff. But I was just curious, because I get, you don't get average people asking for it very often, but guys who are especially in tourist areas.
So just avoid the tourists. Actually, that's another tip for traveling photography. Avoid the tourist areas.
Go off the beaten path.
Do you find that my experience is that the photography gets much better once you get out of the city.
Yeah.
Well, it gets much more unique, and I think that's, it's a good point. You can go, again, to use Thailand as a reference, you can go to Bangkok, you can go to Chiang Mai, these areas that are high on the tourist circuit, and any people that you get are so used to having a camera in their face that they, it's almost like they pose, and they become part of this tourist industry where people take photos and they do all this stuff. Whereas if you step off the path, you go to places that aren't, heavily traveled, and you've done your research, of course, because you don't want to step into areas you're not familiar with, but you get such more unique work that you couldn't have got anywhere else. And you can have conversations or, meet people, engage with individuals that you just wouldn't have otherwise. And most people don't see.
Yeah, definitely. All right. So we're going to come back with your three tips, but before we do, we have a little commercial break.
Of course, Twit Photo is brought to you by Carbonite. And Carbonite, of course, is the fast and easy way to back up your computer in the cloud. And a lot of people, so this is a big deal for photographers, because it was surprising how many people I've talked to that you ask them where their files are, where are all your photos? It's on my internal hard drive. That's where all the files are. And eventually you're going to reach a point where you're going to have an experience that has you not do that, which is that your hard drive's going to fail, you're going to accidentally delete something, you're going to wish you had it somewhere else, and this is what Carbonite really handles. You should really have it, in my opinion, three places, on another hard drive locally, and then you need to have it in the cloud. And with Carbonite, of course, you can make sure that it gets out of your house and into the cloud. And the big thing is that it is now, if there's water damage, if there's fire damage, kid damage, all of those things it's protected from that wouldn't necessarily be protected with just a backup. It's safe. Of course, your files are encrypted before they leave your computer, so you have maximum security. It's easy to use. You don't have to know anything. You really don't have to know anything much more than what you're already... It's much less complicated than using Aperture or Lightroom or anything else. It's pretty straightforward. It's automatic. This is one of the key pieces, is that you don't have to think about it. Once you get it set up, you decide which files you're going to back up, and it automatically is doing that for you in the background. And it just takes a few clicks. Now, once you get it backed up, of course, now you can get it from your iPhone. You can get it from your BlackBerry, for those of you who might have a BlackBerry. I'm not sure if any photographers have BlackBerry. You can get it from your other computers. And so now you have online access for this, and you can really make sure that you can get it from anywhere. And a lot of photographers, you want to show something, you want to print something, you need to get something from somewhere else. And that's pretty key. It's $59 a year. That's 16 cents a day. And you can, of course, get a free 2-month subscription to Carbonite.com if you use the offer code TWITPHOTO. So what you want to do is go up to Carbonite.com, and you can get 2 months for free again. You get a free trial for 2 months. You don't need a credit card. You can simply put in TWITPHOTO, and that will get you started. And you can set up. You can see the password. That's all it is. Those five lines right there. It's not a big, complicated answering tons of things, or four lines there. And you can give it a shot. Start uploading your stuff to the cloud. You'll be safe for 2 months, no matter what. Especially so you can try that, and then see if it works for you. Again, Carbonite.com and TWITPHOTO is the coupon code.
Cool. That's my favorite thing about digital. I used to have obsessions about fires. Because all my negatives, I was like, oh, if I lost all my negatives. So I had a very unrealistic mm-hmm. kind of crazy obsession about things burning down?
I worry about I have been. You know, I have been. I've had someone break into my house and take a bunch of stuff out. You know, and I'm really glad that I had it. A lot of the stuff that was taken.
And the thing is, you have to do it today. Because if you say you'll do it tomorrow, then tomorrow will be the next day.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't have to get into it. Anyway, moving forward.
Carbonite.com.
So, Colby Brown. I asked Colby if there's something about him that people might not know. And he's an artist in many ways. And have you... Tell us about how your body has become an art form in itself.
Sure. So I figured out a handful of years ago that I kind of really enjoyed tattoo art, in the sense that I didn't like to do it, but I like to have it on my body. I think it was I like the idea that my skin is kind of a canvas to some extent. So I have a few tattoos. I actually don't have too many right now. I only have about six. Most of my tattoos have deep meanings. A few of them are even from countries that I have deep connections with, and I think that it was for me, it was really important to get that. So you guys can kind of see, I'm trying to see the easiest way here. I have it's the Buddhist mantra, it's Om Mani Padme Om, on my can't really see it, I keep Jordan. Anyway, it's on my left forearm, which I got from my work in Nepal. I've been there a couple times and it's one of my favorite places. Also have Africa on my other forearm.
Any tattoos in obscure places?
Nothing obscure. I got some on each shoulder. I got one on my back.
Any place that you wouldn't want to show anyone?
No. Every one of them is.
Does your wife have any tattoos?
She has a couple. She has some butterflies actually on her feet. She loves butterflies. And then she has some writing on one of her hips. She doesn't have too much. She likes tattoos, but she's not necessarily infatuated with them.
She's
like
not
I
as
am.
Addicted as you.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm afraid that if I've been working on a tattoo that I'm gonna get.
Oh, really?
So I've been working on the design, but I'm afraid that if I do one,
it's all over.
I'm gonna have sleeves. You know, like I'm gonna come in and
well,
then,
that's
you know,
what Colby's gonna be
know.
Like. We'll interview him in 5 years, and he'll look like a different person.
Yeah. For sure. I already got a couple in my head. I got one from Haiti. I got a couple other locations. I'm just waiting to
he'll
find.
He'll be a map. It'll be a map.
It's going to help my new son to learn the world is from my body.
Oh, gosh. So you have so many beautiful... Oh, that's, by the way, that's a photo of him proposing to his wife.
That is
really
true.
Special. So you had that set up on a tripod. Did she know what you were up to?
She didn't know what I was up to. I was a little bit sneaky in the sense that I usually wake up super early when we're traveling. She comes with me on some of my trips, just to mention that. So she stayed in the hostel that we were in. I went out early to kind of scout out locations. I kind of had an idea that I was going to do this at this location. Lago de Atlan's a beautiful place in Guatemala. And so I came back to the hotel, or to the hostel, convinced her to come out, wanted to take some nice photos because we hadn't taken too many photos of ourselves on the trip so far. And got her out there, and I had everything set up. If you look really, really closely on that one, on the right-hand side, you see that I have actually my remote in my hand. So we took a couple, you know, pictures just hugging, maybe one, you know, with us kissing. And then I got down on a knee and took as many as I could. I think we were both so nervous, though. It was kind of one of those funny moments where we both just stared at each other with our mouths open for about 2 minutes. But it was a unique experience and something that I definitely wanted to give my wife.
So if for any of those fellows out there that might want to do something similar, any tips for setting that up?
Nothing more than just
other
doing
than the remote.
Yeah, the remote helps, obviously, because you don't have to have someone else there. No one else was around. This was at about 5:30 in the morning. Like I said, just do your research. I mean, I had everything picked up. I had everything panned out. I knew exactly where I was shooting. I knew what settings I was going to have, so I didn't have to fumble with my camera. And just create it unique. And being able to adapt, actually. Originally, I was going to plan on doing it at the top of Volcán de Pacaya, which is a volcano just outside of Guatemala City. But we got up there, and there was like 200 other people, and it just wasn't intimate. It wasn't what I wanted. So I kind of changed on the fly, and this was a nice backup option.
So you have such beautiful landscape work. I'm wondering... Are you using any filters on camera? How much are you doing in post?
I it's a mix because I do fine art. I definitely edit my images. I mean, I shoot in RAW. Every photographer, you know, we have to do some editing. I'm a big proponent of both, actually. Some photographers are like, oh, I don't want to carry around filters. I can just do it all post-processing. And some people are purists and I just only do filters. I do both and mix them together. So I typically will go out and shoot images. I have some LE filters. I have a few high-tech graduated neutral density. I use all slide filters. I don't like circle filters because they get... too many times I'd be like in a perfect sunset with perfect light and two filters would get stuck together and I'd just sit there and stare at them and yell at my camera and eventually would lose the photo. So I go all slide nowadays, but I always do brackets anyway, again, because I'm so selective, and then I'll either pick from the best of them or usually I'll do manual blending afterwards.
So what editing software are you primarily using? Are you Photoshop, Lightroom, Aperture? Where do you spend most of your time?
The bulk is Lightroom. I use Lightroom for numerous reasons, for organization, for the non-destructive editing aspects, so that you're not ever, you know, damaging is a loose word, your original files. I do Photoshop for anything advanced, and then I use third-party systems like On1 Software's suite, which is a phenomenal suite. I use some Nik software, maybe when I'm doing black and white conversions with with SilverFX Pro 2, things like that. So it's definitely a mixture of kind of whatever works. Every image I go to, or that I take, I have an idea of how I want to edit it before I start. And the end result doesn't always match that, but it gives me a good starting point. So I've been fairly, you know, like we talked about earlier, I have an idea of how I'm editing this stuff before I even take the photo.
So you have some awesome tips that you've prepared for us. Thank you so much for that. Why don't we go ahead and pull those up?
Sounds good.
Oh, you're talking about the tips.
Yeah, the
Sorry.
Tips.
I had the photos.
Sorry. Too many things to do on the show.
Yes.
Too many things to do.
I don't have that much to do, and here I am. What do I do?
Well, you're listening to Colby. He's very interesting.
Yes.
Or you're checking out his tats or something. All right. So tip number one, use a tripod as often as you can. Why are you making us carry around a heavy tripod?
The reason that I say that, and this is mostly for nature landscape, again, which is the bulk of my passion for everything. The reason that I say that is twofold, is that one, your images will be sharper just in the sense that, you know, the camera is typically more stable. And this isn't for necessarily every type of image, but in general, your images will be sharper by using a tripod. The second most important, second and probably more important reason is because it actually forces you to think about composition. And you know, the photography industry has changed so much with, you know, from digital to film, in the sense where in film you only had, you know, 24 or 36 images per roll, and you had to really, you know, carefully think about what you're doing. You also had to, you know, it also cost money when you were editing your photos. So by using a tripod with digital, I'm hoping that it gets you to think more about how you're composing, what your subject is, and kind of how your exposure is going to be, because it's more of a pain to set up and to walk around with it. So it forces you to think in advance.
What tripod do you use?
Yeah.
I use a couple different ones. My go-to tripod is actually Faisal. I use them for they're phenomenal, smaller organization, smaller company. They're about the same quality as Gitzo, who actually have one of their tripods as well. But Faisal, I find that works a little bit more for my style of stuff. So I have one of their big boys, which is the really sturdy three-section tripods that I use for when I'm kind of going from A to B. And then I have a really light mountaineering tripod when I'm kind of hiking into the backcountry for a few days, because every ounce kind of helps. Yep, there you go. There's Faisal.net is their place. They're phenomenal, phenomenal company.
I have a Gitzo, and it has the Manfrotto, the joystick head, which for landscape is not so important. But if you're shooting people or things where you have to move really quickly, the joystick head is amazing. You just hold it, and because the thing I hate about tripods is all those knobs. You got to like twist them all.
You just want to pull the trigger and move it around.
When you're moving quickly, when you're like, yeah, things have to be done fast, you're in an environment that is
changing. I have a little one of those,
yeah,
ones on one of my travel tripods.
I love those things. Mm-hmm. So I'm all about the joystick. Check out the Manfrotto joystick. I don't even know what they're officially called, but anyway. So moving on to your tip two, learning how to manually blend layers in Adobe Photoshop. I love how you said Adobe Photoshop, as if we had to clarify who made it.
There might be other fake Photoshops around there. You never know. The reason that I say this is that, like I said, I'm a big proponent of using filters on camera. And in fact, I'm, you know, usually more of a proponent of getting things right in camera than having to correct it in post-processing. Manually blending layers, I think, gives you 10 times the amount of control. It's like you know, when someone uses like a Photomatix or a handful of those other type of programs, you're basically allowing the computer to decide how it wants it to compile your initial HDR image. For myself, who kind of likes to stay away from that oversaturated HDR look, which has become fairly popular these days, manually blending layers gives you so much more control so that you can sit there and, you know, take three images from the same scene and then, you know, have one that's exposed for the foreground, one's exposed for your subject, and one's exposed for your background. And you know, editing all three of them individually and then blending them together in Photoshop, like I said, gives you so much more control. And for me, the results are 10 times better than what you get when you throw them into a program to do it for you.
So you're actively staying away from HDR. Why?
The only reason is, you know, HDR has been very popular for the last couple of years. And, you know, Trey Ratcliffe, phenomenal photographer, is a friend of mine. He, you know, he does great, great, amazing things. That style just doesn't necessarily pertain to me all the time. I mean, you know, for me, I like to find inspiration not only from other people's work, but I also like to find it from my own. You know, when I'm having a bad day or I'm sitting there staring at a computer for 12 hours and doing editing, to look at some of my work and to be captivated. For my style and for what I find aesthetically pleasing, I don't like the oversaturated look. I like the more, I like balancing the line between surreal and real. And I think that you don't really get that with regular HDR. Manually blending certainly forces you to spend a little bit more time on it. It's a little bit more time consuming. But as I said, I think the results can be much, much greater, assuming that you're doing it correctly.
Now, you do have some photos that are HDR on your site. Are those ones were an experiment, or are they something different than what we're considering?
No. For the most part, all those were still, most of those are from a few years ago. I still keep them around. I still actually sell quite a bit of them. I still put them up in galleries. I still do like them. But with most of them, I also still did manual blending. So if you look at this image you guys are looking at right now, that's from Rocky Mountain National Park. It was kind of after fall, just as the snow was coming out. And it was the beetles that had killed the trees to give them that red feeling. When I processed the image, the skies and blue, you see this a lot in HDR, kind of an oversaturation of blues, and gives you a lot of like weird clipping and kind of a weird look to it, so to speak. So what I did is I blended all three images. I think I actually originally blended this in Photomatix a few years ago, and then I went back and I edited the middle image for the sky, gave it a much more natural look for what I was looking for, and then I blended that back into the HDR image so that I still did have an HDR image that was compiled, but it did give me a little bit more of what I was looking for rather than, again, just what kind of Photomatix decided was best for me.
Yeah, so it sounds like you experimented with HDR and you've come to realize that you prefer the more natural look, so you use it, but sparingly.
Definitely, and natural is a very subjective, like I said. It usually dances on surreal just because of the higher dynamic range. I mean, technically anything, you know, technically using a filter is HDR. We've just kind of, it's become synonymous with kind of that oversaturated, very storybook, fantasy-like look. So, you know, for me, a lot of people are doing it again, and that was a way for me to help to differentiate. You know, like I said, I'm not upset about it. I actually like HDR. I make decent money selling prints off of it. But for what I personally like doing, it's much more manual blending and more real than surreal.
I think if you started doing HDR on your portraits, I would cry.
HDR on human skin is really weird.
I know. Really, it's like I've seen this fad of it, and I'm like, no. There's a time and a place. Like,
I've not once seen it done well.
Yeah, like, you know what you're talking about, Trey. What Trey does is beautiful. He knows how to use it. He knows where to use it. And there's certain subjects that it really makes it sing. Right. But portraits and skin tone, female skin tone in particular, you know, it's not necessarily... I'm not saying it can't be done because I've seen it done right, but you just really have to be tasteful about it, is the way
Definitely.
I would say.
Well, it's much... HDR, again, is, you know, people have the idea that it can be done with any scene or any type of photo. And while art is subjective, and they certainly can, for the most part, there's certain images, certain colors that work well. You know, there's a handful of great photographers out there that really, I think, do it key. Brian Mateusz is one of them. Ken Kamineski, that really spend the time diving into the details of the image and allowing you to have that kind of almost illustrated HDR look that, again, isn't your typical standard stuff that you see on Flickr every day.
Yeah. So third tip, and I like this one. Find your childlike sense of discovery. Are you a little boy?
I definitely am. I mean, it's that's one of the biggest tips that I like to give out to people. I think as adults we kind of we lose that childlike sense of discovery, that excitement when we see a sunrise or we see a sunset. For someone who's about to be a new parent, I'm really, really excited about bringing a new baby boy into this world, because he has that sense of, you know, this pen or this piece of paper is so amazing. It's, you know, there's nothing more amazing than this, because that's what he knows. So I think that having that childlike sense of discovery, you know, taking that to your photography is key. And what you guys are pulling up right now, one of my favorite quotes of all time is by Marcel Proust, and that's, the true voyage of discovery is not in seeking new landscapes, but in having new eyes. You know, not everyone can travel the world. Not everyone can go climb Mount Everest or do these, you know, go to these crazy locations, but you can find inspiration in your local settings. You can go out to your backyard and your garden and shoot some great, you know, macro work with your flowers. You can take a trip around your local urban city and do some urbex work. I mean, there's so much that you can do out there. You know, you shouldn't rely on the excuse that you know, I can't find inspiration here. If you can't find inspiration in your own house, or in your own backyard, in your own neighborhood, you're not trying hard enough.
Yeah, that's great. So everyone wants to know what's in your bag, and I know you have too much stuff. So let's just go ahead and, why don't you share one, the most common must-have item, and then one sort of obscure item that you have.
All right, so the number one item that I absolutely love to use is actually one of my lenses. It's actually my Zeiss 21mm prime lens. It is the sharpest wide angle lens I think I've ever used. You know, it's one of those ones where, you know, you feel that, you know, you can almost probably cut your finger on it because it's so sharp. In the past I've used the Canon like 17-40, and it's a great lens for the budget, but you know, spending a little bit extra money and getting something that really gives you a lot more flexibility in kind of getting the images that you like. And again, for me, when we're talking about nature landscape and really, you know, jumping up to an f16 or f22 aperture in order to get some details in the foreground and lead it up to your background, for me it doesn't get better than the Zeiss 21mm lens.
That actually looks really pretty, the photo of it.
It's beautiful.
Oh my God, it looks like the most gorgeous lens. I just want to kick it up.
Once you get it in the box and you take it out, it feels like a lens should feel like. And sometimes I love Canon, I love most of their stuff, but you know, when you actually feel the weight of it, you feel the construction. It's like, okay, this is right. This feels good.
Is that
even
heavy?
If you had to pay a lot for it. It is heavy. It is. It adds a couple ounces to it for sure, but it makes up for it more so in, you know, the contrast, the color correction, and the just the sheer quality of photos that you can get from it.
All right, and how about your obscure item?
So my obscure item was hard for me to think of. You know, doing nature landscape and even travel, I don't carry around like funky little tricky stuff. I actually decided to pick my backpack. And I know that sounds a little bit weird, but for me, for the work that I do, both traveling, even doing urban stuff and local other places, to my mountaineering stuff when I go climbing in the Rockies here or the Himalayas, having a quality bag that feels comfortable for long periods of time with a lot of weight makes a huge difference. F-Stop makes some of the best bags in the industry. They started out doing stuff for adventure sports photographers, but it continued to expand. They offer a lot of stuff. Unfortunately, they're a little bit out of stock a lot of the time because they're so popular these days, but it's great. I actually have one of the bags here. This is one of their Tolopa VC backpacks, and it's actually really unique in the sense that they have these ICU, which stands for internal camera units, where you can basically remove this. I can actually take this outside of my bag, put in different sizes ICUs depending on what fits for my needs, so that I can use the same backpack that I know is comfortable if I want to walk around town, you know, with my wife, or if I want to go hiking into the backcountry. I can kind of change it out to fit my needs. And yeah, I didn't want to, you know, make this a whole commercial thing, but they're a phenomenal company, and I love their stuff, and I can't say enough about them. I mean, once you've carried 35 to 45 pounds of gear for 8 hours hiking, you know, 15 miles at 18,000 feet, you'll understand there's this huge difference in quality bags depending on what else is out there.
Yeah, I carry a roller bag.
for sure.
And traveling, we're in a space where I can't, you know, sometimes rollers would suck if you're in dirt, right. But for the most part, I'm not. So I roll. I'm a low pro roller girl.
there's nothing wrong with that. Those are great as well. But I mean, you know, again, if I carried a roller, you know, up into the Himalayas or the Rockies.
Yeah, I don't know how well that would work for you.
A little bit weird.
Yeah. All right. Well, this has been such a great episode. Thank you so much for coming. We're going to close it out by looking at one of your images. And I just want you to kind of walk through and tell your guests, our guests, how you capture this, what settings you used.
Sounds good. Beautiful. So this is Cerro Torre. This is taken in Los Glaciers National Park in southern Argentina. It's one of the more sought-after regions in Patagonia, which for me is a great challenge. I love going to a place that's been photographed a lot and kind of trying to find something unique. Patagonia is also known for crazy, crazy weather. So me and my wife actually spent 4 days at this location. There's a campsite just about 5 minutes from where I took this photo. Without even seeing the mountain, was seeing nothing, just getting snowed on, rained on, all sorts, you know, 90 mile an hour winds. It was crazy. On the last night that we were there, I woke up in the middle of the night, actually just to go to the bathroom, and decided that I should probably check the mountains and see how it was. And it was absolutely crystal clear. There was almost no wind, which is really rare in Patagonia. And so I ran back to my tent, grabbed my stuff. My wife decided to actually go back to sleep rather than come out at 3 o'clock in the morning to wander around Patagonia. I set it up on my tripod. This was actually shot at ISO of 800. The reason that I did this, typically when you do night photography, you have to use a much higher ISO in order to get what you need. I time a lot of my trips actually around the lunar calendar because I like nighttime photography. I like taking landscapes that are lit up. So right now the moon was kind of at a quarter, it was quarter full, so that I knew that it wasn't going to be too crazy to blow out the stars, but it was going to be enough to light up the peaks that I was going after, assuming that I was able to see them at all. I have my notes here, so I'm just remembering the other pieces of it. I shot it with my 24-70 lens. I used the Canon 1D Mark IV, and it was a 20-second exposure. And again, 20 seconds, I didn't need to have it so long. Typically, sometimes you need 30 seconds without getting star trails. Can still work quite well. So it was a 20-second exposure that worked out really well to kind of encapsulate the light and the feeling and the mood of what was happening here. It's a single exposure. I ended up in post-processing, pulling out just a little bit of the light of the details in the foreground, which was kind of the rocks just before Lago Torre. There certainly was a little bit of post-processing, but for the most part, if I showed you guys the raw image, you'd be blown away. It was one of those times where you take the image and you're like, is that real? Did I just do that? I mean, I had an idea of what I was doing going into it, but it was certainly quite interesting. So
it's a beautiful image. Thank you so much, Colby, for being here. Where can everyone find you? Besides, by the way, if you Google Plus, how much do you love Google Plus? I'm like a Google Plus cheerleader.
Love Google Plus. Google Plus is the most engaging social community for photographers out there. If you guys aren't on it, I highly recommend. The invites actually still aren't open just yet to the public. But if you actually, you guys can actually go to my blog. It's a good plugin for my website. It's colbyroundphotography.com /blog. And on the right-hand side, there's a Google Plus icon. Underneath that, there's an invite code that you can use in order to get, I think there's still like 50 invitations left. But it's phenomenal. And this is good. This is actually my blog and website and everything.
Yeah, so. And if Colby runs out of invitations, which happens, I'm hosting a contest on Google Plus right now, and if you go to my blog and ask for an invitation, you can get one from me too. So Google Plus, your blog, your website, any workshops that you have coming up?
I do. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to finish my new schedule before the show because I've been kind of insanely busy. But I do have a new webinar series that I'm doing with On1 Software that starts next month, doing some photo education and talking about the business side of photography. I also have a bunch of on-location stuff here in Colorado in the fall. And then I got a workshop next year in Bolivia and one in Cambodia on the books right now. All that stuff is coming out here in the next week. If you guys have any information or want to be on a newsletter or something like that, just shoot me an email. All that stuff is linked on the blog in the workshop series section. So just let me know.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Colby, for joining us. Thank you so much, viewers, for being here. It's awesome. Love the community. And
another great one.
I know. Another great one. Virtual Five. you didn't do it with me.
Oh, was it me? Or you guys?
Here we are.
Yeah, that was really weak. Anyway, next week, I'm super excited. We're going to have Tyler Stableford. And if you don't know his work, do you know Tyler's work, right?
Tyler's awesome.
Oh, my God. His work's amazing. Makes my jaw hit the floor. Check out his website. It's going to be another great show. And until then, have a great week. Thank you.
See you guys. See
you later. I need a closing line. I'm still working on that one.
Until next week, this is...
Until next week, this is Twit Photo.